for heaven's sake, don't tell Donald Trump, but there is a Miss Mermaid World competition where women dress up as mermaids, including the fishtail, and I'm not sure how they manage the catwalk. And there's a fad called mermaiding, where men and women frolic around in the water wearing a silicone fishtail. But mermaids have always held a fascination for people in their folk tales and mythologies, pretty much everywhere. Stories of mermaids or similar amphibious sea creatures have been told all around the world, including in the stories from Indigenous Australia. Now, these stories have seeped into the popular culture. In modern times, the highest grossing film in China last year was a film called, yes, The Mermaid. And whilst The Mermaid's most popular iteration is Ariel in Disney's The Little Mermaid, mermaids are usually complex creatures, powerful, dark, and often tragic. So why has our interest in these hybrid sea creatures continued? And what part of our collective psyche has created and maintained them? Now, to tell some mermaid stories and try to explain their power, I'm pleased to welcome three women to the program. Jess Phillips first. Jess is a Burundi woman who works at the Bubarara Women's Centre, and she's on the line from Manangreda, a place for which I have very fond memories. The program spent quite a lot of time there with Marcia Langton, Manangreda in the Northern Territory. Kate Forsyth is sitting in the studio with me. Kate is the author, would you believe, of more than 40 books, including the children's books, Two Silky Tales, and all around fairy tale expert. And on the line from Liverpool is Sarah Peverly. Sarah is also an author, medievalist, professor of English at the University of Liverpool, and she's currently working on two books about mermaids. I welcome the three of you to our little wireless program. To you first, Kate. You've long been interested in fairy tales, but there's a family connection that sparked your interest in mermaids, or selkies, as they're known in Scotland.
That is right. Well, selkies are actually men and women who, when they're in the ocean, they are, you know, in the form of a seal, and they swim and live just as seals. But when they come upon land, they can cast off their seal fur just as if it was a coat, and they step out and walk upon the shore in the shape of humans. And long, long ago, there's a myth or a story that a young Scottish man fell in love with a Selkie woman, and he took her seal fur and hid it, and she married him and had children by him.
This is a Mr. McPhee.
Yes, that's right. Well, the descendants were called Mr. McPhee, because McPhee means to come from the dark fairy. And so my grandmother's grandmother's grandmother was called Margaret McPhee, and that means I've got Selkie blood in me. I always liked that as a child.
Isn't there a story that links them to Inuit women in sealskin kayaks?
Yes, that's absolutely true. Anthropologists who have studied the cult of Selkies, or Selkie lore, believe that perhaps the story was inspired by the sight of Inuits paddling in their kayaks, which were then made out of fur. And so in the ocean, they would have looked as if they had the body of a man from the waist up, and the tail or the bottom of a seal in their kayaks. But it's only a conjecture. No one knows for sure.
I wonder, we'll go back to the seal before we plunge further into the story. I've long understood or accepted the hypothesis that mermaids were a projection of sexual fantasy, sexual desire from sex-starved seamen looking at seals.
I've certainly heard that theory before as well. Seals or dungogs, and certainly if you're out on a ship far from land and you see these creatures, you know, swimming with such ease and grace through the through the waves with those big dark liquid eyes and that sleek fur, well, who's going to deny a sailor his fantasies?
I am not in any sense critical. I'm fascinated. What about you, Sarah? What is it about mermaids and merfolk that drew you in?
I think as a child, Hans Christian Andersen's The Little Mermaid story was the one that really hooked me. I had some mermaid toys before that, but I saw a Japanese anime version of Hans Christian Andersen's tale. It was released in 1975, but I wasn't born then. I saw it later on, and I think just the tragedy of it all. It taught me that life is not always fair. I was expecting a fairy tale happy ending and didn't get one. I was so sad that the prince had married somebody else, and I think that was a defining moment for me as a child, but also as an adult, because I continue to love that tale and I see something different in it every time I read it.
Jess, your connection to mermaids is much, much more personal. Tell us about the mermaids of the Blythe River, where you're from. And I know, you know, you are constrained by laws and traditions and what you can actually say, but tell us what you can about the mermaids of the Blythe River.
Yeah, so about 10 minutes ago I actually just sat around with family, and one of the family members, like the owner of that totem, of that mermaid, so he gave me permission to tell some stories. Mermaids out there are like caretakers of the water and caretakers of sacred sites that's there. So they don't really, they've been around from ancestors' time, but they've never actually interacted closely with them. It's always been a distance relationship. They do come out when, if they need to warn you, they come out when there is something wrong with the water. There's always been that relationship that indigenous people look after them and they'll look after indigenous people around that area.
Jess, I understand that some have indigenous women's faces, some are pretty, some are ugly. Sometimes the faces resemble those of people on land, and they come in various sizes.
Yep, various sizes. My grandmother spoke of them as, it's funny how, when every time she spoke of them, she'd roll her eyes like, yes, them, they're mean and ugly. Different sizes. They would appear in different form as well. So they're kind of almost tricky, and then they'll disappear.
Do they ever come on land as the Selkies in Scotland?
No, the only time that if you wanted to have a glimpse of them is, best time would be around moonlight, and you go down the beach and you might have a possible chance of seeing them, you know, bopping their heads in and out. They are known that you could hear them.
You can hear them talking, apparently, sometimes.
Hear them talking or crying. You can hear them having a discussion about you.
Jess, and there are differences between mermaids that live in the fresh water and mermaids that live in salt water.
There's a difference. But there is some stories that some saltwater mermaids have learned to adapt in the fresh water. With the fresh water, they're a little different in the fins. And their hair is more of seaweed or lily pad, kind of that blends in with the billabong or in the freshwater area.
I must tell the listeners, Jess, that Manon Greta is astonishingly beautiful. And the waters, the fresh waters, of course, are full of barramundi and wonderful lilies everywhere.
That's one of the things I've I guess I wanted to talk about these mermaids, that they are in the rivers, and that we need to look after, just look after our waters, so they can continue looking after sacred sites and keep that spiritual connection with the Aboriginal people.
Sarah, I have a passion for ancient Egypt, which of course is full of hybrids between animals and humans, but I can't think of any mermaids in Egypt, but I understand that they do appear in Mesopotamia.
That's right. So Egypt doesn't have the half fish, half female sort of human women that we're used to when we think of mermaids. It has water goddesses, but it's in the religions of ancient Mesopotamia and Babylonia and Sumeria, the Akkadians, that sort of Middle Eastern communities, very early civilizations, that we find the first merfolk, the first proper recorded merfolk. And they appear in the religion. They're linked with the kind of the earliest impulses that mankind has towards religion in a kind of more organized way.
Well, they're fundamental to creation mythology.
They are, absolutely. And there are myths of water deities, water beings coming out of the oceans and bringing civilization to mankind. They bring the arts, they bring culture, and they're to be kind of revered for that. They also have a protective function in Mesopotamian religion.
That in a sense connects them to Jesse's culture.
Absolutely. Although they tend to be protectors of people and places in much the same way as Jess has just explained, but sort of little versions of them, so sculptures of them or seals with them on were carried by people. Clay figures of them were built into the foundations of buildings to protect the building from presumably falling down or from evil creeping into it. So that very much tied to the landscape, and they have a special connection with people. They're kind of interceders between the natural world and civilization as we construct it as humans.
That is very common in almost any mythology, to have a woman intercede between, you know, God and man. In fact, it's Isis, the myth of Isis, and it's also very much a part of the Virgin Mary story. But Sarah, let's go across the Mediterranean. There's a lot of similar imagery in ancient Greece, isn't there? Tell me, are the sirens connected?
Okay, so the sirens first appear in Homer's Odyssey. And Homer doesn't actually describe what they look like physically, but he does give us a location for where they hang out, for where they inhabit. And that's a coastal area because they're placed on a little island. And the nature of their attraction in that great epic piece is their song. They enchant heroes who pass by. They try to distract them from their missions by this alluring song that they sing. And so because they were linked with the seaside and song, the earliest representations of them were bird women, as bird women. But then later on, the iconography develops, and the bird-like features are actually connected with fish scales. So the way that they used to draw feathers and the wings of the birds gets kind of mistaken for scales and fins and different appendages on fish. And they become these fish women. So, of course, all the ideas that are bound up with Homer's sirens, this idea of song and allure and testing, and then later as well beauty, this idea of them as beguiling creatures, this all transfers onto the figure of the mermaid, and that's how we get the connection with danger and female sexuality.
My producer has tied me to the mast, so Sarah, would you be kind enough to sing one of the siren songs?
Oh, I don't know if I should let my voice loose on national radio, but I can certainly tell you the kinds of things that they sung about. They would promise knowledge. So mermaids are often linked with knowledge from a very, very early time. And they would promise knowledge that's beyond the average human being. So they would promise divine knowledge of past, present and future. And that was the siren's original allure. And then later that gets transferred to beauty, and they become these bewitching, beautiful women who will lure men to their doom. And again, that idea comes in quite early. We have it by the 7th century at least.
Kate, you started telling the story about the Hans Christian Andersen tale, The Little Mermaid, and I'd forgotten that it ends tragically. Can you just, because it's so central to what we're talking about, can you just briefly summarise the plot?
I can indeed. Like Sarah, I was enchanted and troubled by the Little Mermaid fairy tale when I was a child. Most people know it because of the Disney version, in which all ends happily. But the original version, which was first published in 1837, actually has a dark and tragic ending, and it's full of cruelty. The Little Mermaid is the daughter of a sea king. She saves the life of a prince on a ship, and she falls in love with him. But she cannot be with him because she's a creature of the sea and he's a creature of the land. So she goes to the sea witch and asks her for a spell to give up her tail. The sea witch says to her, "Oh, yes, I can give you this spell, but every single step you take will be like stepping on knife blades, so sharp that the blood shall flow. And then you must give me your tongue." She says, "Stick out your little tongue and I shall cut it off, and then you shall have legs."
Good heavens above.
I know.
Kate, it seems that there's some sort of Jungian collective subconsciousness that links all these myths.
Yes, you know, the fact that these stories are so prevalent in so many different cultures and in so many different forms, you know, it certainly has some kind of deep mythic resonance, doesn't it? You know, water is often seen as being a symbol of the unconscious and of, I have to say, of the feminine, this idea of the womb as being the inner sea and children, you know, have gills before they are
That's
born.
That's right. I was going to raise that. We do, at one stage, are rather fish-like.
Exactly, and sometimes when they're first born, they are very fish-like. and so there's this idea that, you know, we're all connected by this, you know, sea of the subconscious, these kind of mythic resonances. Perhaps it has got something to do with a longing to be freed from the shackles of our human body, to be able to swim as swiftly and as gracefully.
Well, flight is one all-pervasive dream.
Like a bird.
And this is another, isn't it?
And like a dolphin through the wave.
Yeah.
What child hasn't dreamt of that? And I think it's got something to do with as well this idea of being able to move fluidly between states of being.
Jess, you realise that what our discussion is heard not only all over Australia, but heard all over the world, mainly in that via podcast. But we're talking of a story that has travelled the world without technology. Does it interest you or surprise you what you're hearing from Kate and Sarah, that there are mermaids in all other places around the planet?
Yeah, very interesting. And the different the stories and description. Yeah, very, very different to how we describe them. And I guess mermaid wasn't the word for them. It's long, slender, young woman in the water. That was how they were described in where we are before the word mermaid came in.
Your grandmother warned you not to go out too deep or the mermaids would take you.
Yep. That's still today. A lot of kids get told not to wander off out in the water too deep. That they intend to grab you. And they'll grab you using their hair. I was told that when in the water, look out for hair. That's them.
And you, but this actually happened to you, Jess. Are you permitted to tell that story?
Just one little story of mine that I remember. Just I was in a boat and our engine cord was tangled, and the driver told us not to look because he had seen what was tangled, and being a kid, I looked, and I just saw something that just I can't really explain. It was it was very quick. It was something that just just a lot of hair, a lot of movement, and it wasn't fish. That's just something I've always remembered.
Sarah, I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation that there's a fair bit of mermaiding going on today. There's a sort of a mermaid talent quest that I was hoping Donald Trump wouldn't find out about, and people go mermaiding.
That's right.
And how popular is this?
It's incredibly popular at the moment. It's been popular for a while, since Daryl Hannah made it famous with the 1980s film Splash. Little girls have been trying to make their own mermaid tales, but in the last sort of 20 years or so, it's really taken off. You have a wonderful woman in Australia called Hannah Fraser, who is very famous for mermaiding, and she uses her skills. She can stay under the water for minutes at a time, and she is so graceful and beautiful. And she uses these skills to do something very similar to what Jess was talking about earlier, to try and raise awareness of the ways in which we pollute the oceans, that we pollute waters of various different kinds. It doesn't have to be the big ocean itself. It can be rivers and streams. But she uses her mermaiding to raise awareness of ecological crisis. And this is one of the most powerful things that mermaiding has managed to do over the last sort of decade or so.
It's not only mermaids, it's also mermen. Can we briefly talk about those, Kate? They don't seem to get the same attention or publicity. Speaking on behalf of my gender.
I've often thought that as well. Surely every mermaid should have a merboy to play with. I think it's probably got to do with what Sarah was talking about before, this idea of mermaids as vehicles for female beauty, female enticement and beguilement, and male sexual desire. We see mermen so rarely depicted in art and culture.
Okay, so mermen are around, But another manifestation of what we're discussing was, I remember, 10, 15 years ago, there was a sudden passion for giving birth in the water.
Mm, absolutely, yes.
And that links to what you were saying about, the fact that we, in uterine, we're floating around, and at some point we have gills.
Yes, this idea that, giving birth in water, actually makes the birth process much more comfortable and easy for both child and mother, because, they're supported and comforted by the warmth of the water.
Sarah, I'm talking about human beings all over the world in all times, seem to be able to project all sorts of fantasies and meaning and significance onto these myths. They're very malleable, very adaptable. Perhaps that's one of the reasons they endure.
That's right. They lend themselves to all different kinds of situations. So in the past, mermaids have been used to define religion, to debate politics, to think about beauty and art and how that works. So those are just a few examples, but they certainly are a malleable symbol. And I think they tap into something that's just to pick up on something Kate just said, they tap into something that's always been there in us, that makes us think. They're good for thinking with. I think Levi Strauss said that once about animals, but it's particularly so about mermaids. There's something in them that speaks to our most primordial DNA, I think. We did, as creatures, once emerge from the oceans, albeit millennia ago, but there's something there that connects us with the ocean, that makes us feel its power, I think. And mermaids as a symbol work in that way. They speak to lots of different kinds of things.
I really love that idea. I always say that, you know, the monsters of fairy tales are good for thinking with, because they are metaphors for, you know, human longings, human desires and human fears. And so, you know, just as the ogres and witches and dragons of fairy tales are metaphors for these human longings, so too, I think, are mermaids.
Okay, but for Jess, they're not metaphors. For Jess, they are living, breathing reality. To what extent is that the case for you, Kate, with your family history?
I love the idea that I have Selkie blood, but I, no matter how hard I tried as a child, I was never able to transform into a seal.
I understand you spent a lot of time in the water.
I do. I've always been a bit of a water baby, and I grew up here in Sydney, surrounded by water on all sides.
Water babies, I haven't heard about them for generations. Tell me about, remind me about the Water Babies.
Oh, you know, the Water Babies was a very popular book written in Victorian times about a poor little boy that, I think he was a apprentice to a chimney sweep and then escaped and, you know, was adopted by the Water Babies and was able to escape the dirt and nastiness of his life. It's been a long time since I've read it, but I remember the illustrations vividly, these beautiful kind of, you know, innocent children living and playing in the water.
What about you, Sarah? Where are you on the belief spectrum?
Well, I obviously don't believe that they're real creatures, just because of how I've been brought up and a lot of the research that I've done. But what I find fascinating is, well, two things really. Our desire to believe. It's not impossible that there are creatures, obviously not mermaids, I don't think, but creatures that are still waiting to be discovered. Our oceans are like space.
We know a lot more about space than we know about our oceans.
Yeah, so exactly. That's very, very true. And I think it's that appeal of the unknown. The oceans are this vast space that desires to be explored, but it's not our native element. And we can't live in it as we imagine merfolk might. So there's that side of it, the appeal to the imagination. I would love mermaids to exist, and in my imagination they do, but in my real life I know that they don't. But there's this other side of it as well, and I think this links with Jess's experience, in that for much of our history, it's only in maybe the last sort of 100 years or so that people haven't really believed in mermaids. For most of our history, people genuinely believed that these creatures inhabited the waters, inhabited the oceans, and they may have had them as symbols of other things as well because they're so adaptable, but they genuinely did believe that these creatures were in the water. So we have a very long history of this.
And we probably have a greater need for them as metaphors to go back to the troubles of our oceans and our rivers. Heavens above, I hope Jess is right. I hope that they are there to alert us to those dangers, because climate change denialism needs every possible support. No, not support. We don't want to support denialism. We want to get rid of it. Look, an enchanting encounter. Thank you very much, Jess Phillips, Baruda Woman, and Kate Forsyth, author of more than 40 books, all-round fairy tale expert, and Sarah Peverley, author, medievalist, and professor of English at the University of Liverpool. And we're now going to give a flip of our tails, and off we go into the night. Oh, I'm off, in fact, for a couple of weeks, beloved listeners. And the wonderful Tracy Holmes will be holding the fort for me while I'm in the US. So I'll be back in a couple of weeks. Bye.